This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I have a bit of a cold, but I am pleased to be joined by Michael Hanchard to discuss his new book, The Specter of Race, How Discrimination Haunts Western Democracy. This book was recently published by Princeton University Press. This is a rich and complex study of the question of discrimination in general and race specifically within the field of comparative politics, while also exploring the connection between citizenship and slavery. But slavery broadly understood, not just the United States experience with enslaved persons and the institution of slavery. But I'll ask Michael to tell us a bit about all of these ideas and considerations as we discuss the specter of race. First, I would like to welcome Michael to the New Books in Political Science podcast and to ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Dr. Gorin. I appreciate the opportunity.
Please do tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to this project.
I'm trained as a political scientist, as a student of comparative politics. I'm currently the chair of the Africana Studies Department at the University of Pennsylvania. And I've taught for years a course on qualitative methods. And in doing some research in preparation for the course, I came across an article that was published in 1971 by a very well-known comparativist, Arend Leiphardt. And he cited a series of lectures that I'd never seen before by an Edward Augustus Freeman in 1873. And the title of the lectures were Comparative Politics. I was very intrigued because I'd never in my course of either preparing courses or even as a grad student saw the citation, much less had a discussion with another comparativist about Edward Augustus Freeman's formulations. And it became clear to me the longer I spoke, the more I spoke with a variety of different students of comparative politics, it was clear that most, the overwhelming majority of people I spoke to had not heard of Freeman. What I found was a revelation, in fact, in the series of lectures he'd given. From what I can gather, this would seem to be the first systematic account or treatment of the comparative analysis of political institutions as a science. And the purpose of the creation of this scientific method, according to Freeman, was to prove that across human history, what he called Euro-Aryans were the people and civilization best equipped to sustain a politics of state. They were state makers par excellence. And he began to, as he developed the argument throughout the text, he was clearly making an argument about the nexus or the relationship between race, the idea of race, and political community. And I then began to think about writing a book that would, in some ways, put Augustus Freeman's writings and his legacy in conversation with other periods in the discipline, or the field, I should say, of comparative politics, because no one has written, to my knowledge, about Edward Augustus Freeman's impact upon the field or the discipline.
And so in the book, you bring together a number of threads that you note are not often considered together, as you also just noted. Specifically, this question of the theoretical underpinning of slavery, which is an entire chapter of the book, racial and ethno-national subordination, and the question of democracy in comparative analysis. Can you unpack these parts of the variegated threads that you braid together in your work and explain perhaps why they have not been previously studied in the way that you have pulled them together?
Sure. The argument I put forth in the specter of race will seem to many counterintuitive, if not outright wrong, because I do not juxtapose the practice of democracy against other forms of rule, and specifically societies and political communities that produce obvious inequalities between people, disparities in education, in employment, that are often attributed to distinctions among them gender, ethno-national distinction, religious or presumably racial distinction. And this was something that led me to further explore not just these writings of Freeman's, but other writings and his impact actually on political scientists. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the question of slavery, I think it's important to first mention that the Athenians and the city-states of Greece did not invent slavery. They certainly did not invent racial slavery per se, but slavery became a clear means to provide the material largesse that would enable Athenian citizens to participate in the polity. So here we have, in some sense, this relationship between the unremunerated labor of a certain portion of the population and another portion of the population receiving the benefits of that labor. So in this sense, we can think about citizenship, not just in the Athenian context, but other contexts, as not simply a benefit or right, but also as a privilege, that the purpose of citizenship, in some sense, is to not only provide a set of rights, but also in some sense distinguish the practice of those rights within a political community from other political communities and also from other societies. So what we see in the Athenian context, particularly by 451 BC, is that what becomes clear is that there's a discrepancy or disparity between the people who are members of the polity, that is to say, those people who are invested with citizenship, and those people who are not. And that would include foreigners, that would include women, and certainly would include slaves. And that distinction between society and polity has been carried over and recurrent in what we would call the era of modern politics, that is to say, the politics of state. The earliest democracies subsequent to Athens were also polities and societies that relied on either slavery or remunerated labor. Racial slavery comes later when we think about the transatlantic slave trade, in some sense coinciding in part with scientific racism being preceded by ecclesiastic racism, that is to say, justifications for the enslavement and bondage of certain peoples and not others, that this became a way to justify the enslavement of certain populations and not others. In this case, this would be Afro-descendant populations.
And so in that context, in the book, you specifically explore three Western democracies, France, Britain, and the United States. And you note that these three contemporary democracies construct institutions that come out of embedded discrimination. And you note that those embedded discriminations are of a variety of kinds, and that the institutions continue to be impacted by these constructed differentiations. Can you speak to the reason why these three nations in particular find themselves in this predicament? Are there other countries that have avoided this fate in some way?
Right. No, this is a great question. Well, first of all, the relationship between democracy, the practice of democracy and slavery in these three contexts, I've chosen not because they're the only countries that have undergone this predicament, but they represent at least by the Western narrative, the longest standing democracies in the world. The French Revolution in many ways can be seen slightly differently from the American Revolution in some sense, but neither the French Revolution nor the U.S. Revolution resolved the issue of slavery. That is to say that with the creation of nation statehood, the slavery question was left unresolved. In the case of France, this was a question that really in some ways helped congeal the tension between the right and the left wing of the revolution. Danton, among others, posed the question, well, if we declare and we've crafted a document that grants rights to man and citizen, shouldn't that include slaves? This pattern would be followed. This pattern was followed in the late 19th century and early 20th century in the Haitian Revolution. In many ways, we can think about the Haitian Revolution as the extension of the Enlightenment ideals embedded in the French Revolution, and subsequently in the anti-colonial revolutions in Latin America, the first two decades of the 19th century, where I believe it was 21 out of 23 Spanish colonies had become independent nation states. None of these newly independent nation states resolved the question of slavery, that is the institution of slavery. That is to say, they maintained the institution of slavery throughout the independence period, even though in many instances, particularly in Gran Colombia and Cuba and elsewhere, slaves were often enlisted to fight in anti-colonial armies for independence. They often enlisted in the hope that their participation and loyalty to the new nation would result in their unqualified freedoms. And in most cases, it did not. One of the distinctions, I think, again, it goes back to this question of society and polity, is whether in a particular society, can every member of society, or at least most members of society, be invested with the franchise and with voting and citizenship rights. So this tension between who is privileged with the rights and benefits of citizenship and who are not, we can find in a range of different social movements, particularly over the course of the 20th century, where whether we're talking about the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, whether we're talking about the suffragist or women's movement, the international women's movement, is the question of rights for a specific set of populations.
And so in that context, in this sort of issue of embedded discrimination, you talk about the fact that race itself is also an organizing principle for government and for some of the popular movements. How does this connect with the Athenian experience that you draw from in an understanding of sort of Western slavery?
I guess, first of all, as a comparativist, I tend to highlight the importance of institutions. And institutions are critical in the development of not only racial hierarchies and ideologies, but also in the rule of law designed to separate people, to keep people at a certain status, and in some sense provide status protections for those who are members of a dominant group. So we can think, for example, in the case of the United States, certainly Jim Crow is one example. The 1790 nationalization law, which required that citizenship could be granted, a naturalization could be granted to white men who were not enslaved, in some sense crystallizes this dynamic because it renders politically salient one segment of the population at the expense of other populations within the society, thereby giving that group a sense of privileges that other members of the society do not have. Those excluded members of society eventually spend time organizing and mobilizing to try to either attain the same sets of rights or related sets of rights for themselves. So in many ways, when we think about a variety of different slave revolts, whether in classical Athens, whether in the United States or other parts of the New World, or if we think about anti-colonial struggles, for example, the relationship between Algeria and France, which led to the Algerian war for independence. In each case, you had governments that set up differential citizenship regimes specifically for those populations. Now, part of what the book does, it focuses on the what I consider to be the internal threats to democratic practices as usually constituted. That is to say that democracies can be considered some combination of egalitarian or deliberation combined with action based upon that deliberation. Under those circumstances, then it doesn't necessarily mean that that form of deliberation and action will lead to democratic outcomes for all peoples, right? So one of the questions the book poses is really, which were really central to think about this question or connection between what I call racial and ethno-national regimes, is really a twofold question. Who should labor and who should rule? Followed by a more fundamental question, is democracy for whom? Does that answer the question?
Yeah. And your book really dives into that broad question from so many different perspectives. And I think it's really important to think about that. And I think you do a great job sort of trying to pull some of these threads together in the comparative perspective, which is also what I want to ask you about. In the book, you're making an effort to examine, quote, the continuities and discontinuities in race thinking among students of comparative politics. And you say that, you know, you talk about how this is a very important aspect of understanding the three stages of the development of the field of comparative politics. Can you explain what students of comparative politics and everybody else who studies politics should understand, not only from examining contemporary comparative politics, but also from the periods that precede our current moment?
Okay. So I guess first, we can think about, particularly in a contemporary moment, there are many pundits and scholars, but also everyday citizens who treat the current moment in the United States of heightened xenophobia, of an uber nationalism, or of fascistic tendencies in an uncivil discourse as something new or peculiar to U.S. democracy. We go back, for example, to World War II. We can actually go further back, but just to give you an example, the Nisei, the American-born and U.S.-born Japanese citizens who were interned in various camps because they were considered threats to national security. Give you an example of the ways in which nation states privilege certain populations over others. The other continuity between the Athenian moment and moments like this is that moments of perceived political crisis, that is to say, when a society or a state feels threatened, either externally or internally, is when we often see the activation of these kinds of practices designed to isolate, further minoritize, and subjugate certain populations and not others. The other issue to think about is the way I think about, particularly the part of the book where I explore E.A. Freeman as a sort of neglected legacy within comparative politics, is for many years, I mean, certainly throughout my career as a comparativist, I've heard in talking to colleagues, from students I've trained who submitted articles to journals, to be told that the study of race has nothing to do with the study of comparative politics, and that articles or projects which focus on race and comparative perspective are usually better off to be found or to be submitted to journals on racial and ethnic studies. So what Freeman provides in some sense is a counterpoint to suggest, no, in fact, one could argue that the history of the development of a scientific discipline, however, and this, I'm using scientific in this sense in quotes, because Freeman basically already had his answer to a loaded question, but certainly we can't deny the centrality of racial hierarchy in his determination of who would be best suited for political rule. I mean, he had a hierarchy which placed Afro-descendant people, in which in one of his writings, his travelogues, because for a while he had a brief career in the United States as a public intellectual. And these entries are collected in a volume called Impressions of the United States. He makes derogatory comments about African-Americans, about Jews, about the Irish, about a range of different people. And what I came to find out in the process of doing this research is that Woodrow Wilson, who took his PhD at Johns Hopkins and worked in Herbert Baxter Adams' seminary of historical and political science, was influenced by Freeman's beliefs. And in fact, in his book, The State, and actually in an earlier version of the book, The Modern Democratic State, Wilson made a pronouncement that has eerily sort of echoes of Freeman's pronouncements, where he claims that racial homogeneity is the first prerequisite for society that would be democratic, right? So in many ways, it was suggesting that that homogeneity, societal and population homogeneity, would produce political stability, political uniformity, and would lead to democracy, right? So for Freeman, for example, the United States was peculiar not because of its experiment with democracy, as the Tocqueville would have us believe, but the fact that allowed so many different so-called or presumed races of people who inhabited the United States to actually become members of the United States political community. And this was, for him, a very dangerous experiment.
And so with regard to the sort of understanding of the birth, I guess, of comparative politics as a discipline, where, as you know, there's a lot of sort of privileging or, you know, expounding on the merits of democracy.
It's
also that democracy itself is in that context by these thinkers was posited to be one that was best when it was homogeneous, or at least the polity, as you note, is homogeneous as opposed to the society in the Athenian construction.
Right. Well, in the book, I mention and describe three different moments or iterations of comparative politics.
That was my next question. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I certainly can. And that first iteration is the neglected iteration of Edward Augustus Freeman. The second iteration begins with the SSRC's sponsored Politics of the Developing Areas project. Which involved not just political scientists, but anthropologists, and many of whom were studying what came to be known as the Third World, or developed or underdeveloping areas of the world, and a prospect for democracies in these parts of the world. Much of this scholarship focused with a partially explicit declaration that in order for a society like Ghana or the second Western colony on the continent to achieve political independence. The first was Sudan, that they had to, in some sense, guard against and rid themselves of both tribalism as well as follow a West-centric model of politics, which could in fact lead to democracy. The irony in many of the scholars in the comparative politics of developing areas of cohort is that they were trying to develop a new vocabulary or language to think about comparing political institutions across time and space. Gabriel Armin, for example, well understood that there were certain inherent biases in the ways in which certain parts of the world were analyzed, which were too filled with basically bigoted opinions or prior judgments or prejudices, which limited the ability of analysts to actually understand and find parallels between political institutions say, for example, in Madras State in India, or in Accra, Ghana, for that matter. So in some sense, they sought to, in some sense, make the practice of the science of comparative politics more scientific and more systematic, if you will, so that in many ways it kind of predated or set up for a more positivist and post-behavioral movement within the discipline to basically believe that methods could be transported from one place to another, and local context in many ways would be considered secondary. So these, and then by the time we get to the era of perestroika, in many ways perestroika was anticipated by the politics of the developing areas movement, but it was more targeted at the profession itself and the increasingly positivist shift within the profession of political science more generally, and it's certainly within comparative and IR in particular. And this was argued in part by the collapse of the Soviet Union, and not just the Soviet Union, but the dream and project of the Soviet of the Soviet bloc, right? So times of, and on the practical side, times of crisis, as in the case with ancient Athens, classical Athens, Athenian citizens and elites were concerned about being possibly overrun in the Persian War. They're also concerned about the possibility that citizens who had become indebted to foreigners could be converted into slaves. And so the mythological narrative of citizens being descendants of those who sprang from the earth became a way to provide a protection, right, against Athenian citizenry from enslavement. If we think about the autochthony myth of classical Athens, it bears a lot of striking parallels between the racial and ethno-national chauvinisms of modern politics and the ways in which laws get crafted in response to perceived crises in order to protect a certain population, to privilege a certain population and not other populations.
So, I mean, you are doing an amazing work in this book, because you are pulling together, you know, sort of about five different questions, and trying to explore, you know, as you say, the specter of race. But it's not just about race; it's also when slavery becomes racialized, as you note. But you conclude with this question about cultural pluralism and democracy, and whether the prospect for democracy, particularly our modern democracies, can exist and build polities, norms, and societies that allow all members of a given society to participate equally, stripping away distinctions of gender, social class, religion, ethnicity, origin, and racial distinction. The history that you note of societies that make a promise of egalitarian ideals, but have social and political orders that are built upon the dominance of particular ethno-national groups or races, have scrambled the mode of analysis and have also provided the problematic of balancing cultural difference and democracy. So I ask you, is there any hope?
Right. Okay. So let's deal with the question of hope first, and then I can give you some examples. I'm actually less energized by questions of hope. I'm more energized by questions of will. Do societies and states have enough political will or communal will to address the roots of xenophobia and of racism and sexism in their societies? I don't want to leave the impression that I think that distinctions of gender, social class, religion, ethnicity, and racial distinction can be stripped away. What I'm trying to suggest is that in a more ideal society that is democratic and both plural, that those distinctions aren't rendered with political value. That is to say, to render one form of identification as being more politically salient, more politically important than others. That's when you get the development of racial regimes and national regimes, in part because these regimes are not static. So when we think about the United States, for example, one of the issues that became clear after the Civil War is that, you know, with the rise in certain areas of the country in status of freed persons who were literate, who in some, you know, isolated cases could generate wealth and actually have a say in the polity, this was seen as very threatening, particularly in the South, to an idea about white supremacy and white rule, right? And so when we think not just in these contexts, I can give you examples from other parts of the world. If we think about the current crisis of the Rohingya in Myanmar, right? They are represented as an outside foreign population. They somehow trouble the integrity of the country, and there need to be either legal safeguards or extrajudicial means to repress their presence in that society. So, and that, in some sense, is a response to the question: what do you do with people considered unfamiliar or foreign in their midst? And this, in many ways, is an old question that goes back, in fact, to the expulsion of Moors and Jews from Spain. Can these people be assimilated into the society and subsequently the polity? Should they be repressed, marginalized, and minoritized, or should we take the genocidal route? Right? And we've seen, whether we're talking about Nazi Germany, Myanmar, we're talking about responses by white nationalist groups, not just in the United States, but certainly currently in the EU, we see different responses to that question. And basically all three of the responses above. So finally, if we think about the connections, and the last part of the book is an epilogue, which entitled From Athens to Charlottesville, the language of the white nationalists in Charlottesville of blood and soil, Jews will not replace us. These are all naturalizing metaphors to suggest that these people, the so-called Aryans, were the first people or the people first empowered to rule in the nation state called the United States. And one of its most prominent exponents in the days immediately after Charlottesville was someone who, like many of his other colleagues in his cohort, argued that the United States should be and was in some sense designed to be an ethnostate. And in some respects, if we think about the Constitution and its amendments, they're not entirely wrong. The question is, what would it look like now to create an ethnostate? It would essentially involve the process of either marginalization, liquidation, and at least in their case, the argument is that there could be no prospect for assimilation because mixing so many different peoples in a polity is like mixing oil and vinegar. And in this sense, I see both the U.S. Civil Rights Movement as an incomplete project. I see many different movements around the world as also incomplete projects. And it's important to remember that some of the most powerful movements, social movements and political movements of the 20th century have been identitarian. They've been based on a response to some form of original or generating exclusion of a certain group, which in turn responds by trying to energize and mobilize members of that group to make political claims.
And in this way, just one last question about the book. How does race connect to nationalism in this regard?
Well, as I just mentioned, and certainly in certain cases, there's a belief that somehow race signifies a certain form of purity and a push to homogeneity that occludes and in some sense ignores the reality that even before what came to be known as identity politics or multiculturalism, that most national societies we can think of across the world were already multicultural societies. If you think about you know, with the collapse of the Habsburg Empire, the range of different nationalities that came to constitute what came to be known as the non-historical nations by the moment of decolonization, roughly between 1945 and 1970, most of these former colonies turned independent nation states were also plural societies. So plurality has been with us within the nation state system for a long time. Many of the current problems of, particularly within the EU and discussions about immigration, I would argue, and I argue in the book, are really not questions or arguments about immigration. It's really about who shall we let into our country, and by what criteria do we exclude and include people? And if we just think about the difference between the treatment, say, for example, of migrants or people coming in from the north of the border, northern border of the United States to the southern and southwestern border of the United States, it's hard not to come to the conclusion that the different sort of governmental logics informing the border protections at both of these places are intrinsically racialized and heightened in the
current world. Yeah, I mean, your book is really fascinating for bringing all of these ideas together, particularly with the grounding in an understanding from Athens of like who was a citizen and who was in the society but not a citizen, which I learned a lot from that discussion in particular. So I was wondering, Michael, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a book in some ways, which is from surplus material from this book. And it's about the relationship between fascism and racial rule. There's been a lot of very interesting scholarship over the past few years that looks at some of the colonial roots or origins of fascist violence, whether we're talking about Germany, whether we're talking about Portugal or Italy, and that the political imaginations and coercive imaginations of Mussolini and Hitler and Salazar were informed by their prior activities in the colonies. And so one of the parts I want to argue in this book is that many of the discussions today about contemporary fascism, there's often a way of lumping together fascism with authoritarianism, with a range of other things, but few commentators actually look at the relationship between fascism and racial rule. And I think what they'll find and what I hope to render visible are the ways in which racial rule provided part of this sort of political language and grammar for fascist governments. And here I'm talking about fascist governments, not just fascistic movements.
Okay. So the actual ruling of a fascist government as opposed to movements that might move in that direction.
The need to restore order, we need to restore the primacy or the sort of integrity of the citizen, which is racialized, the use of imperial colonial expansion to prove the vitality of the nation after a period of decline, certainly in the German case and in the Portuguese case, often through the occupation and colonization of subjected peoples in both instances in Africa. This is in some sense part of the legacy. And we even think about, for example, paramilitary movements in the United States, which in many of these cases have as their target minoritized populations and also progressive populations who are seen as a threat to their dream of an ethnostate.
So when you finish this next book, will you come back on the New Books in Political Science podcast and discuss it with me?
Oh, I would be more than happy to. I'm quite grateful for this initial opportunity, and I hope I have more opportunities to talk to you and your audience.
I'd love that. So now's a chance, if you have your favorite brick and mortar store or not, where can a listener buy your book, The Specter of Race, How Discrimination Haunts Western Democracy, published by Princeton University Press? Where can somebody pick up a copy of this book?
Well, thanks for the advertisement and support. Well, the closest one to me at the University of Pennsylvania is the Penn Bookstore is doing, it's highlighting my book, and I'm going to do a presentation from parts of the book on October 30th of this month.
So listeners, if you're in Philadelphia, you should go to the Penn Bookstore and hear Michael Hanchard, right?
But it's available at most major bookstores in the country. It should be, at least, and certainly academic-oriented bookstores.
Okay. Thank you, Michael Hanchard, for joining me today. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thanks so much for great questions. I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you.